Fine. I'd like to ask for your attention for some considerations, pursuing what we started this morning. So, this morning, the question was, how do I know that what I experience is mindfulness? How do I know when I'm actually mindful? How do I know when this mind is attentive, when it is aware, when it is conscious, when it is present? How does it feel when it is not present? I'd like to give the answer myself this afternoon. What does actually happen when my attention is not in the present moment? What does happen? What are the telltale signs? So, I just look at that from the perspective of Buddhist psychology. Buddhist psychology says, speaks of five specific hindrances that stop us from stilling the mind and sustaining attention on present recollection of what is happening. Present time recollection. There are five specific things. Three and a half, just up front, three and a half of those things have to do with thinking. Yeah. So maybe that alone says something. The hindrances are quickly named. The tradition calls them sense desire, calls them ill will, calls them sleepiness, drowsiness, lethargy, torpor, calls them agitation and restlessness, calls them doubt. One of them is a double hindrance, double whammy. Yeah, number four has two parts to it, the physical part called restlessness and the mental part called agitation. So these are all big terms. Yeah, if you ask people, are you in the throngs of sense desires right now, they would probably say no. Yeah. These are terms that are too big. Yeah, they evoke kind of lustful, almost ecstatic experiences. But in fact, Buddhist psychology is pretty strict there. Any pleasant experience which we wish to prolong, any seeking of gratification in one of our six senses, any hanging on to something that is right now quite nice to me would classify as sense desire. If you're a meditator, since your means of gratifying your senses are somewhat curtailed, as you sit here and your eyes are closed and you're not supposed to run around or do things, that sense desire will manifest as forms of thinking. It will manifest as forms of thinking things that give you pleasant feelings. This is morally completely blameless. Yeah. This is not a category that has anything to do with ethics or morals at all, what I'm talking about. So we're not talking about morality. We're not talking about what you should or shouldn't. We're not talking about counting your sins or something. Yeah, just to be clear. We're speaking about conditions that stop this mind from experiencing continuity in its attentional process, continuity in its process of stilling the mind functions. That's one of the things we're interested in, because such stilling helps the mind to become more clear, helps the mind to become more transparent for what's going on in there. So traditions long before the Buddha have appreciated that. So what does it take for our mind not to become still? It takes some form of seeking. It takes some form of looking around. It takes some form of pursuit of gratification. Yeah? Remembering nice things, planning nice things, trying to warm up nice things, chewing on things that right now give me nice feelings and try to prolong them. All of these things entail a certain degree of activity. Yeah. And all of these things are by definition discursive. All thought depends on the discursive nature of our mind. And now in that discursive nature of our mind, the mind will never become still. Just never. Sometimes it will become a little more still, but you know, your thoughts have many friends. Yeah, they have extended families. They have many brothers and sisters. And if you start talking with these thoughts, and generally thoughts talk. I don't know what yours do, but mine talk, they say. Believe me, I am important. Do something about me. Don't just sit around here. I am the last thought. Think me to the end and then I'll be peaceful. They say things like that. And obviously we go for this, yeah? If we, as soon as we negotiate thought on a content level, we actually meet the thought, not as a thought, but we speak directly to what's inside the rucksack, yeah? It carries, then we're gone. Generally we're gone. Then we agree and say, oh yes, 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 more of it. This is, it, I think the same. You're completely right, yeah? Or we think, no, 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 this is not true. No, this is imprecise, or I disagree, or oh God, yeah? We respond to the content of the discursive activity, and we're engaged in some form of dialogue, yeah? Condoning, or pleased, identified with, or we're torn. But in some way, we talk to the thought and what it speaks. And there is an appeal in that thought. Now, sometimes this is very useful. Yeah, in the dialogue is a useful skill, and much of our survival here, not being concerned so much with saber-toothed tigers anymore, but with managing complexities and processes, streams of information, being able to think and have access to creative and evaluating in a dialogue is very useful in our everyday life. So nothing against that. Problem is, it doesn't make us still. It doesn't make us happy. Problem is, it doesn't stop. Yeah? Ever sat in a train looking out of the window wishing that that guy knew that keeps commenting the nature of the universe, yeah, would stop giving, handing out labels, passing judgments, giving a running commentary on life. Ever wished that this could quieten down? Well, maybe you're to be congratulated if you've never been there. Maybe you have more gentle minds than I have one, but I definitely have wished so. So what is the problem with this thought? Problem, even with nice thoughts, even with useful thoughts, is that they do preclude the mind from going a layer deeper, going deeper than the discursive crust in which much of our attention in life is focused. Buddha took up the yogic model of the mind, and with some criticism, he has basically taken the fundamental premises. And the fundamental premises, there is a surface of mind which has to do with thinking, with wishing, with conceiving, with image creating, with impulses of various nature, impulses like a disinclination, an intention, the wish to push something away. Yeah, so volitional impulses and conceptual processes which have to do with image and the putting together of individual thoughts. So this surface, like the surface of the sea, is never really quiet. Yeah? There is always some waves going on. Now if our intention is to make these waves still, then we're trying to iron out the waves on the sea. While we chase one and try to pacify this one, another one will rise up. The surface generally is not still. It's in the nature of that surface not to be still. A healthy mind will produce intentions. A healthy mind will produce images, will produce creative thoughts, will produce wishes and likes and pass judgment on things that are disagreeable. It's kind of vain to hope that we could just hover at the surface and wait till it gets quiet. So the yogi tradition suggested to find the stillness of mind that we, instead of trying to pacify the surface and negotiate the surface so that it becomes stiller, we shift our attention to other processes than discursive thoughts. rather than waiting for the waves to become still, we decide to go in more deep. We decide to shift our attention to other processes of our experience. We are very preoccupied with discursive experience. Yeah? Most of you will be quite happy to spend several hours without experiencing a specific taste, without doubting your existence. But, you know, 2 consistent minutes of no thought in your mind might actually already be slightly threatening and might make you slightly worried whether you're going to turn into a cabbage or so. We're highly identified with the content of thought, highly identified with our discursive activities. We groan and sigh and say, oh, if only it would stop. But when it does stop, not a few of us are afraid. Yeah. Find it quite worrying, disturbing, certainly. 2 minutes of empty mind, yeah. Just direct immediacy of experience, no cognitive commentary. Quite a disturbing experience for some of us. So we're highly keen on having things going on in our discursive layer. So there is a bit of habit of seeking in there. And that habit of seeking is what keeps the motions going. That's what keeps the waves moving. And as long as our attention rests in that domain, the mind will not become still. The yogic tradition put it very bluntly, Patanjali, of whom we don't quite know when he actually lived, starts his Yoga Sutras just and states, meditation is citta-vritti nirodha, the cessation of all mental functions. Yeah? Which is a bit brutal at a first glance. This is not really what would help us raise our kids or hold our jobs or, you know, meet the challenges in our life. But it is clear that in that statement is understood that those processes of mind which we so highly identify with and which we keep seek gratification within, these processes are the very processes that stop the mind from becoming still, becoming happy, becoming clear, and becoming content. Yeah. If we want stillness, if we want contentment, and if we want a deeper understanding, and these processes stop us from such understanding, from such contentment, then we need to be prepared to at least temporarily let go of them. And we do that by shifting consciously the focus of our attention on something else than thought, images, memories, fantasies. And because that's not quite easy, we need to do that with some practical forms. We need to exercise this. What else stops the mind from becoming still? The seeking aspect, if you want to speak psychologically, takes the oral position. The seeking aspect is, this is nice, but it is not enough. Please give me more. Or I'd like the green version of it. Or can I have it tomorrow again? It likes to have more, yeah? The seeking pattern would like to prolong. If I can have it now, in my mouth and in my ears and in my nose and on my tongue and on my body, I'm happy to have the sensory experience. If I can't have it, I take second best. I go for the memory or I go for the fantasy. Yeah? I get the cookie, I'll eat the cookie. I don't get the cookie, I'll fantasize about cookies. Yeah? So, since right now is not cookie time and you're here, meditation is the moment when you will be fantasizing about cookies or memorizing cookies or planning how to do them or planning how to vary them, the ones you have already done, or planning how to do them with less fat or with more chocolate. And the very thought, although it's very different from a cookie, a thought, actually gives you a sort of feeling of cookie. There's a similarity there. Although you don't actually get a cookie, you know, your system doesn't actually get the sugar, there is a sweetness to that thought. There is a sweetness to the plan. There is a sweetness to the memory of the cookie. You know, you can really, with a little practice, you can actually get yourself salivating. Yeah? You can get almost, you know, texture of the crumbliness of a type of cookie, you know, your memory is remarkably well in its recall. Particularly if you're, say, fasting for a few days, you can remember things you would not have thought. How accurate. You can actually sit there after 7 days of not eating and suddenly your tortelloni gorgonzola come in a vividness you couldn't think. Yeah. You didn't remember the stuff while you were eating. You've actually forgotten that you've eaten them, but when you're actually there, and the memory comes up, combined with the mind-seeking, who is now for a couple of days deprived of the oral pleasure of eating, there's a vividness to that recall in your memory that is very strong. So let's not fool ourselves. The things, even if we have only memories or fantasies of them, are very, very powerful. Sometimes that is useful. Sometimes that helps. Sometimes that gives us strength. Think of the choir of slaves in Nabucco, yeah? Forgot what it is. Va pensiero. You know, the thought that moves into freedom, yeah? Or if Natasha Kampusch is locked up by her torturer, 10-year-old girl, and after 2 years, she realizes she has more psychological strength than her capture, and she knows that she one day will come out. Yeah. She's been locked up, no window, a damp, small, little confinement, completely handed over to this man's whims, and yet something in her knows that she will get out. And that thought holds immense power. Yeah. That thought gives her in that complete helplessness, objective outer helplessness, that thought gives her tremendous power and strength. So sometimes thoughts can really do powerful things with us. But often it's not the case. Often our thoughts are not really our friends. Our thoughts are detractors. Our thoughts are splitting up our energies on possibilities. Our thoughts are passing judgment on ourselves. And our thoughts are not helpful. So it is quite useful to be able to regulate the intensity, even the frequency of thought. It is quite useful to be skilled in shifting our attention from being obsessed with thinking and being subject to the content of our thought, to content on which we have very little influence, by the way. It is very helpful if we can shift our attention from obsessing with that dimension of our experience to another dimension of our experience, which at the first glance may not be very fascinating, but which may hold great promise for contentment, for stillness, for happiness, for clarity of the mind, say. Something as simple as a bodily sensation. You must have noticed that all meditation traditions emphasize bodily awareness. You go to the Japanese, you go to the Tibetans, you go to the Koreans. Every of these traditions understands that we have to learn shifting our attention from the habitual discursive dimension into the body. Now, we quite like having bodily sensations if they are particularly pleasant. Yeah, if we're comfortable, if the body enjoys, if it has enough to eat and enough to sleep, and if it feels well, or if it experiences pleasure, we're quite happy to be with the body. We're also with the body if the body is in pain. Inevitably, we are, in a grudging way, we are present in the body. But there's a huge segment in between the pleasure the body can experience and the pain the body can experience, a huge segment in the middle where we're pretty bored with bodily process. Yeah, we're not really fascinated with thinking what happens to the meal we have just eaten. Yeah, this is not very fascinating. Yeah, kind of following your peristaltic movements or so. This is not what most people would spend much time on. Yeah. It's much more fascinating to follow clever thoughts or angry thoughts or desirous thoughts or creative thoughts, or even inane thoughts are probably more attractive than attending to your digestive movements right now. Yeah. So it is fair to say that most of us spend probably attention on bodily processes if the body has a pleasurable experience, or we spend our attention on body if the body is in pain and we can't help being attentive to that. So shifting from thinking, imagining, memorizing, remembering, fantasizing to feeling sensations, even mild and even inane sensations, is unusual. So it takes some effort. What else can stop the mind from thinking? The next one is annoyance, ill will. This is a mind that seeks fault. This is a mind that practices discontent. So with the same passion which we can pursue things that are pleasurable, that are gratifying, we can pursue things that we feel discontent about. Things that make us feel bad, things in which we think badly of others, things in which we look for fault. There's a beautiful little term for that. It could have been a very psychological term. In Pali it's called randa gavesi. It means looking for the cracks. You know? It's a kind of the fault-finding mind. Now, it's interesting why we should think things that give us bad feelings. It's not obvious. It's quite obvious that we should think things that give us good feelings. That makes sense, isn't it? It gratifies, gives us a pleasant warmth. But why should we think things that give us bad feelings? It's not apparent. But we do so. If you speak with people, they're quite happy to think things that make them feel bad. People are not just attaching to things that make them feel good or that are positive. It's disturbing to see how willing we are to attach to things that give us perfectly miserable feelings. We do that generally to sustain a sense of identity. Because one of the things we really can't handle is incertitude. It's not knowing who we are, not knowing where we belong. If we have the choice, we probably would take a positive identity, something that gives us a good feeling. But if that doesn't seem within reach, we're quite willing to go for a self-definition that is negative. Yeah? Say, I'm a loser, I'll never get what I need. Or, I'm just not good enough. Or, you know, I'm always too late. You know, there's always one quicker out of the block than I am. Or things like that. We're quite happy to identify with negative positions because they give us some form of identity. The thought in itself is unpleasant, but the identity we get is slightly reassuring. It gives us some comfort. We know where we belong. We know what's happening. At least we can recognize this kind of reality because we've already been there. It gives us the semblance of competence. At least we know what it is. So quite a few of us have established patterns of thinking along lines of discontent. We are specialized in looking for mistakes, for flaws, for faults, for lack of quality. Sometimes we pride ourselves, yeah. We're sharp. We're not easily pulled, you know, we don't have easily pulled the wool over our eyes. Or, you know, we don't suffer fools gladly, or this kind of attitude. But often it's it's just bad habit. We've established thinking in critical terms of the world and inevitably also of ourselves. So we think and put our attention to things, and the general climate is one of ill will, the one of aversion. 2-3 drops of vinegar in our blood, yeah? A slight acidity, slight sourness in our judgment. And that can feel quite reasonable, yeah? My aversion type inside, that can sound quite reasonable. You know? Often speaks of quality, or speaks of responsibility, or speaks of that's not proper, or, you know? It's a kind of reasonable sound to it. What it is, in any way, is a thought. It is judgment, it is cognitive, it is discursive. And however reasonable or however neurotic this is, in either way, it is going to keep the mind busy, again, at the surface of its world. It's going to keep the mind at this discursive, in the discursive layer. In that layer where there is no peace, where there is no profound stillness, in that layer where, in fact, I'm only warming up my past. I'm warming up old perceptions, I'm warming up my own value judgments, I'm warming up my memories. In fact, in that layer, I can never meet anything new. That's a real drawback of the discursive layer. I can never think anything genuinely new. As long as I think within the terms and perceptions of that which I already know. This is a real drawback. If you want to be creative, particularly a creative thinker, this is a real drawback. To acknowledge to yourself that you'll never ever think a new thought unless you're willing to go below the layer of thought. Everything new, everything genuinely creative will come from somewhere else. It will not be a rehashing or a rearrangement of your cognitive processes, of your thinking processes, because that thinking is based on perceptions, and those perceptions are right now old mind. They're yesterday's perceptions. So the second big hindrance is ill will. Yeah? The third one is an honest hindrance. It hasn't to do anything with thought. It has to do with lethargy. Sometimes that lethargy is just lack of energy. Sometimes that lethargy has to do with lack of definition of your exercise, your task. Sometimes it has to do with lack of sleep. More often, it has to do with compensating previous degrees of tension or activity. So people live highly busy lives, and then they come for a weekend retreat, and then they wonder that they're kind of drowsy. You know, they kind of live on the fast lane the whole week, and then their systems are overtaxed, and then they think they can just come and plunk themselves down and meditate in, you know, fantastic samadhi. Mostly, the mind needs to recover. Yeah? If you're living on the fast track in much of your life, have a very stressful and high volume sensory input life, then it is very likely that when your mind realizes the pressure is off right now, you know, I can make a little break, yeah. I recover a little bit. So sometimes our lethargy or lack of engagement has to do with compensation. Sometimes the lethargy that can come up in our meditation and lack of the mind's ability to engage may have to do with non-acknowledged aversion. Yeah. Sometimes we don't want to be with what we actually are experiencing. And one way of not feeling what we experience is just numb out. Yeah? We just kind of numb out. We go slightly opaque and things fuzz out at the edge, and then I kind of zone out a bit. Yeah? All goes into a pleasant sort of blur, no hard edges. That's it, isn't it? That is, Buddhism is about peacefulness, isn't it? That's quite peaceful, actually. Yeah. That's getting there, yeah? Very peaceful. Yeah, that's what it is about, isn't it? I can feel the sweetness coming. Yeah, this is peace. So, sometimes the things we are asked to be with, if we honestly turn inward and we sustain our attention on our experience, is painful. It's not flattering. And one way of sparing ourselves that pain is just fuzzing the edges. Yeah? It's just blurring out. Don't know what you call this glass you sometimes have in the toilet. It's kind of opaque glass. Yeah? Just the world moves behind that type of glass. Yeah? You still see a few sort of schemes, but basically the edges are gone, the hurt is gone. Sometimes our psyche protects itself. You know, you want to go and have deep, profound meditative experience, but Monday morning you've got to be back functioning. And while one part of you is really pushy and wants to get in there and find out and confront and be with and let go of, investigate, another part realizes this is not safe enough. Yeah? There's not enough time here, or I don't have the circumstances for safely going into deep process. I'm just not doing this. Yeah. But if you're a willful person, then you just try to push that part aside. You don't negotiate with that part. And that part might just sabotage your meditative ambitions. Might just say, it's just going to pull the emergency brake. Just put them to sleep. Yeah. We're kind of we're closing down here. I'm afraid this is too dangerous. We're closing down. Sorry, he wants to do ambitious things with my psyche that I'm not going to handle, because I know I got to be functioning next Monday. Sorry. No. So he's going to doze for the next 2 hours. So sleepiness, if that is a recurrent thing, I know some of you are new to this. You will have to be aware that some of the others are doing this for years. So you have to be selective of what is for you and what isn't for you. If you're doing this for a long time and sleepiness is an issue in your practice, and I don't know any serious meditator who has been at it for a couple of years who would not have encounters to hindrance of sleepiness or lethargy. Generally, if you haven't experienced that, it is because you're still too excited with irritation or with seeking or with just general stress levels. Yeah. Actually, breaking through to sleepiness may be a first achievement. So if lethargy and sleepiness are recurrent issues, you need to widen your inquiry. What might be going on there? You need to find out whereby you are not sleepy. Yeah? Indications of a sleepiness that is not due to lack of sleep or lack of physical energy is when you're bright awake, somebody tells you to meditate and you start getting drowsy. Yeah, and the world kind of moves away from you. Or somebody rings the bell after you've been dozing and nodding off, and you, a moment of wonderment, and then you're bright awake, yeah, and you walk out. When that happens a couple of times, you notice there's something specific to your sleepiness. It's meditation induced. Yeah, that's the type of sleepiness you definitely need to investigate. Along the lines I just suggested. The fourth of the hindrances has two parts. The first part is physical restlessness. That means you suddenly get an itch. Yeah? You get a tremendous impulse to move something, yeah, to crack a vertebrae or to stretch a limb or to readjust your posture, or you get some strange sensations, kind of ants crawling up and down of your neck, or heat in unexpected spots, or shivers, or all kinds of things. Yeah. It is as if your body is producing symptoms to stop you from actually becoming quiet. And the impulse is to do something. Yeah. So you scratch, you change address, your posture, you kind of wriggle, you clear out the fold from your socks and out of your trousers, you change one leg around, and then the other leg around, and you loosen this and you tighten that. Yeah. So when you follow that impulse, generally it helps for about 20 seconds, and then the next such impulse comes in. So you can kind of fidget around for a whole hour, which is not very useful in terms of your own stillness, and it's definitely not useful in terms of helping others finding stillness. Also, it doesn't resolve your issue, because the issue is not the specific sensation you're trying to alleviate, but it is a tendency of restlessness in the mind that somatizes. And the cheapest way to get out of this is basically don't do it. Yeah. Spend some time adjusting your posture when you begin. Make sure you're as comfortable and as good as you can, and then try to hold that posture. If you find it unbearable, negotiate with yourself. Once, twice, thrice. Negotiate before you follow an impulse to change posture. If you have decided that this is still unbearable after the third time, change your posture. And when you want to change your posture again, negotiate again with yourself. Yeah? It's important to establish an impulse control. So as long as we let impulses run through of that nature, they will always disturb our intention to still the mind. The second part of that fourth hindrance has to do with agitation now of a mental emotional nature. It has to do with things that you remember in which you have acted in ways that are not honoring what you actually feel or what you know or what you hold dear as values. In other words, it's either your conscience or it's some form of shame or it's some form of repenting, or you become aware of something in which you feel that either your actions or your omissions have left you with a bad feeling. It is, you know, the Buddha, like Socrates and Jesus, start with the human beings are sensitive to an ethical dimension. And if we don't act in accordance with that dimension, then we get bad feelings. Yeah? Sometimes these bad feelings are because of our proper inner sense of values. Sometimes we feel that we haven't lived up to some of the things that others expect from us. Yeah? Either way, conflicts of that nature can be quite disturbing. Yeah? If you have ever botched up in your life in that dimension, you know that whatever you do and wherever you go, you won't find any peace. Yeah. There is really, remorse is a big issue. Yeah. If you really have remorse, guilt, however neurotic or healthy, this is really an agitating experience. Why is this a meditation hindrance? It is a hindrance. Why? Well, because you cannot do something about it right now. Right now, in your formal meditation practice, when you sit still, when you're trying to still your mind, occupation with these thoughts are something that stops you from becoming quiet. Right now you don't have a level of activity possible that would remedy that. You may have to remedy that in your life, but right now the only thing it does, it stops you from stilling your mind right now. Again, this is a cognitive process, so this is half of three hindrances is cognitive as well. It's about thinking. The last one is doubt. Doubt is a really interesting one. In my understanding, doubt is an emotion, an unpleasant emotion connected with something you don't know. Now, there are many things I don't know which are not doubt. It's just an open question mark. I don't know what I get for breakfast tomorrow morning, but it doesn't create much doubt in me right now. Yeah? There's many things along those lines. But doubt is something I don't know and I feel I should know. Yeah? Is this right or is this wrong? Do I love her or do I not love her? Should I stay or should I go? This kind of thing. Ethical doubt, in fact. Ethical doubt, as an unpleasant emotion, leaves us with a highly unpleasant sensation, a sensation which we tend to distance by thinking about it. Yeah, you've noticed one of the things we stop feeling what we feel is by thinking about it. And in many ways, this doesn't work. You know? We try to distance ourselves from the unpleasant feeling of anxiety, and by thinking about anxiety, generally we feed the anxiety. The same holds true for anger. If we try to not feel what the unpleasantness of anger in the body does by thinking about anger, we are highly likely to fuel that anger by thinking angry thoughts. Doubt is the same. Raw material for doubt is just about everything you know. You know? The more you know about something, the more you can use that to doubt. If you're highly knowledgeable about human anatomy, you can have the most florid fantasies. What could go wrong with you right now? Yeah. Really? Was this just a little twitch at the back of my neck, or was this the beginning of a severe cardiovascular incident that is just about to break loose on me? Was this just a strangely weird perception, or is this the onset of a major psychotic episode? Yeah? Is this just a little numbness in my right toe, or is this a clear indication that I'm about to lose my leg? Because, you know, nerve is not just slightly pinched, but is actually atrophies while I sit here and talk. The more you know about that thing, the more you can make yourself crazy. So, that's one thing about doubt. It is it feeds on practically anything you know. So you cannot protect yourself against doubt through knowledge. The other thing is doubt weakens you. Doubt always leaves you in a sense of vacillation, paralysis, being torn. It completely undermines any sustained course of action. Again, doubt is, as an emotion, is unpleasant, and to stop it from happening, we tend to react with frantic cognitive activity, creating structures which, you know, you work your way through probability scenarios. What is the worst thing that could happen? What are the indications of that? What would be indications of that it's not quite as bad? What would be the most positive outcome? Can I kind of really be sure of this? You know, you can create huge amounts of structures to cope with doubt. And any such structure will depend on thought, a lot of thinking. And again, that will keep you in the layer of waves, of discursive waves, and that will prevent you from really experiencing the depth of the mind, you know, the other pole of the mind, which is still, which is clear, which is calm, which is the surface of the mind and the depth pole of that mind. And as long as you fixate it with your attention on the moving, the discursive wave surface, then there is no chance that we really become still. So, the truth is there are not really good tricks to get out of these hindrances. Yeah? I have described these hindrances now as meditational hindrances, but actually the resolution of these hindrances is only in our lives. Yeah? There are no meditational tricks. Yeah? You can get rid of some sleepiness by massaging your earlobes or by standing up. You can get of some itchiness by determination of will. You can maybe contemplate some of the unattractive features of the things you find attractive or your mind playing with. Or you can try contemplating the harmfulness of thoughts fueled by ill will. But basically, these are only tricks. Yeah, this is kind of local patching up. Yeah, this is symptom management. The real resolution of these hindrances can only take place in our lives. What is important with these hindrances is that we recognize them if they take place. What we recognize, hey, this is thought. Okay, fair enough. This is the fifth time I think about this theme. I think about this person. Obviously, is this pleasant or is this unpleasant? Yeah. Do I think of this in a sort of loving, fondling way? Or do I think of this in an averse, rejecting way? Might be worth actually acknowledging to yourself this. All these things can go wrong with our attention. If we look at what can go wrong with our attention from a psychological point of view, how could it feel if things go wrong with my attention? What can happen with my attention so that I lose present moment awareness? One thing is I can be losing the mobility of my attention. Yeah? Something happens and all my attention gets focused on there and I can't get out of this anymore. Yeah. Life continues happening. I move out of the room. I walk down the lane. I meet somebody I know. I go into a bus. But my whole attention is focused on what she just said 15 minutes ago, and that hurt me so much. The one thing that can happen to my attention is I can lose its mobility, its flexibility. I can be fixated on something that has taken place and I can't get away from that. If we want to name losses for attention, loss of flexibility would be one loss. What else can happen? I can lose my body. Yeah? So I can be completely dissociated from my body. I can be so focused on a particular state or on a particular project, on a problem, that I can stop feeling what the body feels. That's not difficult to see. Plenty of us enact that. You see people walking like that through their lives, yeah? Slightly leaning forward, their heads ahead, heads heavy with ideas, and then, you know, the feet trying to carry the poor body along. Cephalopodos is a good example of this, yeah? A huge head and tiny little feet. Ever try to be really in a staircase while you're in a staircase? I don't know, for years I've had a practice of taking one stair at a time, because I found when I lived in the monastery, I never want to be in the staircase. You know? I never want to be in the staircase. And it's very difficult for me to actually walk up stairs normally. It was always an impulse to just take three or four of them in one jump. So I realized I need to learn how to be where I am. I need to learn in the body, in the staircase, where I don't want to be. You know? And I do that by taking one step at a time. So for years, this was my practice. You would think people do more lofty things in monasteries, but then walking one staircase at a time. But for me, this is a very, very powerful practice. I still feel the impulse. It has not died down. It is I have a bit more leeway whether I engage it, yeah. If I have to catch a bus, I allow myself to do that. I am not like poor Thich Nhat Hanh, who can never run to take a telephone anymore because he's now such an icon of taking three breaths before he does anything. Yeah, I'm very glad that I'm still less of an icon, that I can allow myself to run and jump for a bus. But I do recognize that the impulse to run and jump whenever I see stairs has something to do with my preoccupation of where I want to go and my unwillingness to be where I am now, which is in a boring staircase. And the fact that I call this boring has something to do with my unwillingness to be where I am. And I realize this is a problem. Thich Nhat Hanh or Akinjana doesn't matter, this is a problem. If I want to be happy, this is a problem when I'm not there, where I don't want to be where I am, basically. Yeah. So, losing body is one way we can get lost, or our attention gets lost. Sometimes we lose the big picture. Again, our attention shrivels to one aspect of our experience. Say, pain. Yeah. You have a little pain in your finger. You've cut yourself while doing the onions, and then that little stupid pain that isn't even infected properly, you keep feeling that the whole day. Yeah. The whole day. Every time you touch something, this is that little finger, which you don't think of a tiny bit, in most of your life, suddenly seems to crop up. Every 30 seconds, it hurts you and says, hey, here I am. Look, I'm hurting. And our attention can focus on this. This is a silly example, but we all know that pain can reduce us. Pain can dramatically reduce us. If a body is in pain, all our great thoughts are very likely to be less great. Yeah? All the things that you feel hankering after and that you feel so chuffed by will pale when your body really is in pain. Yeah. All the inner space, maybe even your samadhi experience when you're in pain, can fade. Yeah. It's quite humbling to experience when you think of yourself as a good meditator, what happens when you have 39.5 fever, you know. How good are your chances to do jhanas when you have 39.5 fever? My chances are considerably diminished, I can assure you, and I've been doing this for a number of years. So it's quite humbling, yeah? Body's a little bit out of kilter, and the world suddenly looks different. Did you know that your brains aren't actually made so much for thinking? The major task of your brains is actually modulating body states. It's not these fantastic neocortical activities we're so proud of. Actually, it's modulating body states. This means that you get goose pimple if here somebody opens the window a bit too long, or that you get nausea when you don't have enough oxygen, or if your blood sugar levels drop, you start having a healthy appetite developing, or things like that. That's what from an evolutionary perspective, your brain is about. Brains take bodies very, very seriously. So losing the body is a risk, really a risk. Not just will you lose sensitivity, not just will you lose the care you need to award this body with. You will also stub your toes a lot more often. Yeah, you will bang your head a lot more often. You will develop unhealthy eating habits. You will develop all kinds of other things. So bodies need to be attended to. And if our ideas get so obsessive that we lose the body, then we have definitely an attention problem. Yeah. Sometimes our attention can get lost if we lose the other. Yeah, there are other human beings out there. I know it's difficult to prove that you are not just a modulation of my consciousness. If I wanted to insist that you had to prove this, you would probably find that quite difficult to prove, but there are other people. You know. I need other people in my life. In fact, the chances of being a human being without other people are fairly minimal. There's a couple of things you can learn on your own. But there's a couple of things you can learn only through other human beings. Empathy, attention, speaking, to just name a few. This won't happen on its own. Yeah? If you're out there on your own, completely left to yourself, your peace, nobody wants taxes from you, nobody bothers you, nobody takes your parking spaces. Yeah, could be quite a happy thought, isn't it? Me, all these annoying other people who jam up the tube in the morning, they're all gone and I'm just happily left to myself. But actually, there's not much about humanity if it is not taught by other humans. We learn being human by other humans. And a couple of things, very dramatic things, like empathy, attention, communication, we only learn via others. So if we lose the other, we're in trouble. Now, if something happens in our life that makes us lose the sensitivity and the availability in our attention for other human beings, we're in trouble. We're very likely to be obsessed with something. We're very likely to experience profound states of isolation. And this is not healthy. This is a bad starting point for happiness. So losing the other is one way we could say attention can get lost. Sometimes we lose the space. Our attention can either become bitty, fragmented. We have 1,000 pieces of information which we juggle, but somehow we've lost the sense for the connective tissue. We've lost the sense what we're doing that for. All we get is little annoying stimuli which don't coalesce into a meaningful picture anymore. So we lose the space of our lives. What is important? What hangs together with what? And all we get is tiny little fragments of impingement. So our lives can feel very scattered, can feel very torn, can feel the bits which we negotiate can feel disconnected. Ever been there? Even when you get good at negotiating the individual bits, somehow at the end of the day you feel tired and it doesn't somehow leave you with any sense of contentment. So bittiness, if that is an issue in your life, may be an indication that your attention gets lost. So think. Think of attention and if we speak of, in a very simple way, that mindfulness is if attention becomes fluid. That's a very simplistic definition. I wouldn't, if I had to judge myself for that definition, I probably wouldn't let it go through. But take it as a very simplistic notion. If attention is continuous, that's when the magic actually starts. Since we're all episodically and topically attentive. The real magic starts when that attention reaches a certain degree of continuity. And if it has this fluid quality to it, then we could start calling the activity of attention mindfulness. There are a few other components in there, like interest and like type of awareness and the spatial quality and the probing investigative quality. But fluid attention, I think, deserves the term mindfulness in my books. If we are interested in that, we need to look what stops us from being such fluidly attentive beings. We need to find out what our stumbling blocks are. We need to find out something about our habits, about our conditioning. Whether you want to do that in psychotherapeutic terms or in psychological models, I don't care. Frankly, it doesn't matter, to be honest with you. But if you're interested in cultivating stillness, contentment, understanding, you will not just need a vision for that. You will also need an interest in how to be introspectively engaged in finding out what you are already doing. Because what you are already doing is the starting point of developing all the stuff the vision may speak of. So we need to become interested and curious in what we're already doing, what is already happening. And I have to acknowledge this is utterly counterintuitive. Yeah? This is radical. It is radical because of what I said this morning, namely that our attention is geared to maximize pleasant experiences and minimize unpleasant experiences. And the very thing I just said, namely that we have to become curious and interested in what we're already doing, stands completely counter to this conditioning of seeking pleasure and avoiding displeasure. Radically being aware of what's happening is a challenge because it goes counter to our intuition of seeking categorically the pleasant and moving away from the unpleasant. There is some radicalness in this. So unless we're willing to go to challenge that conditioning, unless we're willing to look into the patterning of our attention, it is unlikely that we will find out how to maximize attention and how to minimize the things that squander our attention. Whether you want to apply a Buddhist model of five hindrances or the psychological model of getting lost, as I have just done it. So, for those of you who are on their first meditation event, this is probably a bit over your heads. But if you're getting curious, just take what you pick up and come for more if you're curious enough to continue this. Otherwise, there will be plenty of people who speak about this coming here. Yeah? And I would like to suggest a small break and then some walking meditation.